always rise to. There was a wedding party in a nearby village that night. Lebanese wedding parties are held on the eve of the marriage. Thus, the groom is given an excuse for looking green at the altar. 100 or more chairs had been placed in a circle behind the bride's house. A few light bulbs were strung in the grapevines, and a huge table had been laid with food, scotch, and arrak. Parties in Lebanon start slow. Everyone sits primly in the chairs, neither eating nor drinking, and talking only in low voices. Or they would, usually. In this case, the men and boys must all discuss politics with the American. Every one of them has cousins in Texas. "Just tell them what you think," said Billy. I couldn't very well do that. After a week in Lebanon, what I thought would hardly make fit conversation at a wedding feast. This was a Christian village. "If the Muslims take over," said a young man, Billy translating, "they'll close the bars during Ramadan. But we don't make them drink at Christmas if they really don't want to." A lather of self-justification followed. Justifying the self is the principal form of exercise in Lebanon. The principal form of exercise for a visitor in Lebanon is justifying American foreign policy. The Marine incursion was the question of the hour. Muslims wanted to know why the Marines were sent here. Christians wanted to know why they left. And Druze wanted to know why, during the Marines' brief stay, they felt compelled to shell the crap out of the shuf. My answer to everyone was that President Reagan wasn't sure why he sent the Marines to Lebanon. However, he was determined to keep them here until he figured it out, but then he forgot. Nobody held it against me personally. The Lebanese never hold anything against anyone personally, and it's not considered rude to root for the home team. There were a number of Muslim guests at the party. The villagers had nothing but affection for the Druze Billy Haddad, who towered over most of them. One teenager, summoning all the English at his command, told me,
"Billy, il est l'homme vert, tu connais. Credible Hulk!"
Billy said the only real trouble he's had with his neighbors and tenants was when he tried to convince them that professional wrestling is fake. It's the most popular program on Lebanese TV. About 10 o'clock, there was a change in the festivities. Acting on some signal I couldn't perceive, everyone suddenly began to drink and shout. A little later, the bridegroom was carried in on the shoulders of his friends, accompanied by drums, flutes, and the eerie ululation Arab women use to mark every emotional occasion. Awful tapes were put on a large Rasta box. There was bad Arab music, worse French rock and roll, and Israeli disco music, which is the most abominable-sounding thing I've ever heard in my life. A sister of the bride got in the middle of the circled chairs and did quite a shocking traditional dance. There was something of the freshman mixer to the crowd. The young men and women held to opposite sides of the crowd, eyeing each other furtively and being shoved out to dance only after prolonged giggling and conspiracy among their fellows. "I haven't been laid since I was in Beirut last June," said Billy. "Out in the country, it's marriage or death." Good fellowship in the Middle East can be a bit unnerving. You'd best get used to being gripped, hugged, and even nuzzled. I was taken aback the first time I saw two fully armed militiamen walking down the street holding hands. Large amounts of arak aid in acclimatization. The sense of affection and solidarity is comforting, actually, when you realize how many of the men throwing their arms around you have pistols in the waistbands of their pants. A Mercedes full of gunmen kept watch on the road. Eventually, I was thrust onto the dance floor and matched with a hefty girl who had me do Arab dances. This was, justly, thought hilarious. But my discotheque dancing made an impression. I gather the locals are not familiar with the Watusi, the jerk, and the mashed potatoes. The whole celebration was being videotaped, and every now and then one of the revelers would use the Sony's quartz halogen light to dry the skin on a snareless Arab drum. Sometime in the early morning, Billy and I returned to his farm. There was protracted questioning from his housekeeper on the floor above. She wanted to make sure we were us before she threw down the door keys. We locked ourselves in with 5 deadbolts. I never did get to see the historical points of interest in Sidon. The overland crossing going north was a horror. The Israelis run Batar and the Midpoint Interrogation Center, and conditions there are ugly but organized. However, the clumsy and violent South Lebanon Army has control of the Jezzine checkpoint. There were about 1,000 angry and panicked people in the small town square when I arrived. Most of them were poor Shiites, and all of them seemed to have screaming children and every earthly possession with them. One group of 200 or 300 were fighting with fists to get on a bus. Soldiers ran through the crowd, screaming and firing Uzis in the air. It was only 10 in the morning, but already 90 degrees. I looked for Israeli officers. There were none. I sent Simon into the crowd. He returned in a few minutes.
"No ways but bus across," he said.
"How do I get on it?"
"You cannot."
I paid him off and sent him home. I was sick with the dysentery every foreigner in Lebanon suffers. My head ached from the wedding party Iraq. There was, it appeared, a man with a gun selling bus tickets. But every time he tried to sell one, a crowd of 300 would rush him like a rugby scrum. The man fired his pistol directly over the people's heads. Bullets smacked into nearby masonry. The crowd quailed and ran backward, trampling each other. Then they gathered themselves and rushed the ticket seller again. He grew purple with shouting, reloaded, fired again. The crowd moved away and back like surf. Then, with one great surge, they chased him on top of a truck. Most of these people had been camping at Jezzine, if that's the word for sleeping in the streets for days with your children and no food. They were desperate and fully insane. The crowd began running against itself, into walls, up the sides of buildings. I was at a loss. I might be at Jezzine still, if my arm hadn't been grabbed by someone who said, "I ken you're new here." It was a magnificent Scotswoman, tall, thin, and ramrod straight. With her was a gentle-looking Lebanese girl. The woman was Leslie Phillips, head of the nursing school at a medical center near Sidon. She was on her way to get textbooks in Beirut. The girl was named Amal, the same as the militia. It means hope. She was headed to America for college. Miss Phillips placed us in a protected corner and said,
"I'm going to speak to the man with the gun. I always go straight for the man with the gun. It's the only way you get anywhere in this country."
She vanished into the melee. The crowd went into a frenzy again and made right for Amal and me. I suppose I would have been filled with pity if I'd been in a second-story window. As it was, I was filled with desire to kick people, and I gave in to it. Miss Phillips was gone for 2 hours. She emerged from the Donnybrook perfectly composed and holding 3 bus tickets. I asked her what all the shooting was about.
"Oh," she said, "that's just Lebanese for please queue up."
An ancient, horrible Mexican-looking bus pulled into the crowd, smacking people and punting them aside. Amal was carrying a co-ed's full complement of baggage in 2 immense suitcases. I handed my kit bag to Miss Phillips, grabbed these, and made for the bus. Or tried to. 3 steps put me at the bottom of a clawing, screeching pileup, a pyramid of human frenzy. I heard Miss Phillips's voice behind me.
"Don't be shy," she said. "It's not rude to give a wee shove to the Lebanese."
I took a breath, tightened my grip on the suitcases, and began lashing with Samsonite bludgeons at the crowd of women, old men, and children. If you ask me, it was pretty rude, but it was that or winter in South Lebanon. I fought my way to the side of the bus. There was a man on top loading luggage and kicking would-be roof rack stowaways in the head, knocking them back on top of the crowd. I hoisted one of Amal's 50-pound suitcases onto my head, waved a fistful of Lebanese money at the loader, kept hold of Amal with my other hand, and fended off the mob with both feet. This doesn't sound physiologically possible, but it was an extreme situation. I got both suitcases on top at last. Then we had to scrimmage our way to the bus door in a flying wedge, Miss Phillips leading the way. Just as we were getting aboard, a worse brawl yet broke loose in the throng. One of the South Lebanon army guards leapt into the middle of it and began beating people in the face with the butt of his pistol. The crowd exploded. Miss Phillips was heaved inside. I was squashed against the bus door and lost hold of Amal, who was sucked into the maw of the Lebanese. Miss Phillips reached out the bus window and tapped the pistol-whipping soldier on the arm.
"Pardon me, lad," she said, "but those 2 are with me."
The soldier left off his beating for a moment, pushed me into the bus, and fished Amal out of the crowd. I pulled her inside, and the soldier went back to hitting people. Everyone in the crowd was yelling. I asked Amal what they said.
"They're all claiming to be someone's cousin," she sighed.
About 200 people were packed inside the bus, which was built to carry 50. More kept wiggling in through the windows. It was well over 100 degrees in there. Every now and then, a soldier would get in and climb across the top of people to beat one of the illegal passengers. There was more shooting outside. I found myself in a full body press with a Shiite girl. She was rather nicely built, but over the top from claustrophobia and shrieking like a ruptured cow.
"What's Arabic for calm down?"
I yelled.
"As far as I can tell," said Miss Phillips, "there's no such word."
We did eventually get underway, the bus backing over people, then swaying horribly in blinding dust on the half-lane wide mountain road. We were only stopped, unloaded, searched, interrogated, and held at gunpoint several times. Fortunately, the Lebanese are a clean people, even the very poor ones. It wasn't like being packed into a bus on a sweltering day with a bunch of French or anything. Akbar was waiting at Badr. I found out later he'd also come up from the city the day before and waited all afternoon in case I got thrown out or evacuated or tried to get back to Beirut on foot. Travel to the north is less arduous. George Mall, the video editor at ABC TV's Beirut Bureau, and I went on a trip to the Bashari Cedars. Traffic on the coast road north of the city is stalled by checkpoints. Amazing what a few guys standing around with guns can do to create gridlock. "I Heart Lebanon" bumper stickers are popular with the motorists. "Kill them all, let God sort them out" t-shirts are popular with the militias. It's important to remember, when dealing with these militias, that the gunmen are mostly just kids, and they're getting a big kick out of the whole thing. I suppose this is only natural when young people lack proper recreational facilities and well-supervised activities to keep them out of mischief. They need sympathy and understanding, or a 16-inch shell from the battleship New Jersey. I wanted to visit the Gorge of the Nahr el-Kalb, the River of the Dog, a strategic point on the Lebanese coast, just north of Beirut, where for more than 3,000 years, invading armies have carved stelae commemorating their passage. A tunnel for the coast highway now cuts through the gorge wall, and the carvings are reached via a ramp above the traffic. The cuneiform characters of Nebuchadnezzar II, the stela of the Pharaoh Ramses, the Assyrian bas-reliefs, a Latin inscription from the Emperor Marcus Aurelius, Greek carvings from the Seleucid Empire, they've all been completely effaced by air pollution. Don't go to the famous Jida grottos at the source of the Dog River, either. These have been turned into a military training base. Although what kind of military training goes on among a bunch of stalactites lit by colored spot lamps, I can't tell you. A few miles north of Nahr el-Kalb is the Casino de Liban on Shouri Bay. This was pre-war Lebanon's attempt at Monte Carlo and used to have elaborate floor shows featuring plump blondes who were out of work in Europe. You can still gamble here, though just being in this part of the world is a gamble enough for most people. The blondes are gone. On up the coast road, 24 miles from Beirut, is Byblis. Since the Christians were run out of the Beirut airport, the Phalange has taken to landing planes on the highway here. Expect another traffic jam. Byblis was considered by the ancients to be the oldest city in the world. In fact, it has been an established metropolis for at least 6,000 years. Main Street, however, looks most like the oldest part of Fort Lauderdale. By the seaport, however, is an Arab fortification atop a Frankish castle constructed with chunks of Roman temples which had been built over a Phoenician town that was established on the foundations of a Neolithic village, quite a pile of historic vandalism. The war has not touched Byblis except to keep anyone from coming here. We found one consumptive tour guide playing solitaire in a shack by the entrance to the ruins. He took us through the deserted remains spieling, with pauses only to cough, a litany of emperors, catastrophes, and dimensions. The Lebanese are chock full of knowledge about their past. Those who do learn history apparently get to repeat it of their own free will. The whole business filled me with inchoate emotions and a desire for lunch. The Byblis Fishing Club at the base of the Crusader seawall has wonderful food and no other customers. They don't speak English anymore, so I went back to the kitchen and picked out what I wanted. Seafood got with dynamite fishing is very tender, it seems. On the wall of the fishing club are dusty photos of better days. Ray Milland, Anne Margaret, David Niven, Jean-Paul Belmondo.
Now this, said George, is archaeology.
There's a very good hotel in Byblis, the Byblis sur Mer, whose owner hadn't seen anyone in so long he bought us drinks when we stopped to use the payphone. You can proceed to Tripoli on the coast road, but shouldn't. The Arab Democratic Party, which supports Islamic unification, is having a big fight there with the Islamic Unification Party, which is in favor of Arab democracy, and the Syrians are shooting at both of them. We turned east toward the mountains at the Syrian lines near Badrun. There's a medieval Arab castle here that's worth seeing. It sits in the middle of a cement plant. Once into Syrian-controlled territory, the checkpoint scrutiny becomes severe. Ahmed, our driver, began making long explanations to the glowering soldiers. He wouldn't quite confess what he was saying, but I have an idea. It went something like,
I have the brother of an important American strongman here, and the president of England's cousin. They are traveling in secret as journalists, so they may see the justice and resolve of the great Syrian army in its struggle against Zionist oppressors everywhere. Soon they will return to their homeland and tell rich men there to drop a bomb on Tel Aviv.
The Syrian army has dozens of silly hats, mostly berets in yellow, orange, and shocking pink, but also tiny pillbox chapeaux, peaked officers' caps with half a foot of gold braid up the front, and lumpy Russian helmets three sizes too large. The paratroopers wear shiny gold jumpsuits, and crack commando units have skin-tight fatigues in a camouflage pattern of violet, peach, flesh tone, and vermilion on a background of vivid purple. This must give excellent protective coloration in, say, a room full of Palm Beach divorcees in Lily Pulitzer dresses. The rest of the scenery is also spectacular. Californian, but as though the Sierras had been moved down to Santa Barbara. The mountains of Lebanon rise 10,000 feet, only 20 miles from the sea. You can ski in the morning and swim in the afternoon. Actually, of course, it's raining on the beach that time of year, and the skiing is mediocre at best. But it's the kind of thing that made for great Lebanese travel brochure writing in the old days. We drove to Beshari on the lip of the dramatic Khadisha Valley, 650 feet deep and only a half mile wide. This is the heartland of the Maronites, 7th century AD Christian schismatics, who sought refuge among these dangerous hairpin turns, lacking guardrails and speed limits. Beshari was the home of Khalil Gibran, and also where Danny Thomas's family comes from. Thus, the two great cultural figures of modern Lebanon, though in many ways opposites. Danny Thomas does not write poetry. Khalil Gibran never did spit takes. Are linked. Or so I was told. I wouldn't spoil that piece of information with research. We visited Gibran's house above the town. It's probably the world's only example of the California bungalow style carved out of living rock. Interesting, but damp. The place is decorated with 100 or so of Gibran's artworks. He was a dreadful painter. The gentle insouciance of Rodin and the technical abilities of Blake, all done in muddy earth tones. Gibran's coffin is bricked into the wall of his bedroom, if that says anything about the man. While we were asking directions in Beshari, a young man named Antoine attached himself to us. He got us into the Gibran house, which was supposedly closed for repairs, then took us home for a Lebanese sit-around with his mother, aunts, sisters, cousins, etc. Hospitality is a must in the Middle East, whether anyone wants to have it or not. Pomegranate juice is served, lots of cigarettes are smoked, and tiny cups of coffee are drunk, while everyone smiles and stares because you can't speak Arabic and they can't speak English, and Lebanese are the only people in the world who pronounce French worse than Americans. Antoine's house was extraordinary. Like Gibran's, it was carved into the side of a hill. The main room was windowless, floored with layers of Persian carpets, and hung, wall and ceiling, with ornate cloths. There were stuffed falcons, brass things, photographs, and religious statuettes all over the place, and a dozen mafia Mediterranean-style dining room chairs. Antoine let us know he thought Khalil Gibran's house was under-decorated. Antoine's mother told us that she'd lost 5 sons in the war so far, though that may have been the usual polite exaggeration of the Levantine. Ahmed, though Muslim, was a great hit with Antoine's family. He brought them up to date on Beirut politics and then told Syrian checkpoint stories. Syrian checkpoint stories are the Polish jokes of Lebanon. A Syrian soldier stops a Volkswagen Beetle and demands that the driver open the trunk. The driver begins to open the luggage compartment at the front of the car.
"No," says the Syrian. "I said the trunk."
"This is the trunk," says the driver.
"I am not a donkey," says the Syrian, pointing to the back of the car. "Open the trunk."
So the driver does as he's told, exposing the VW's engine.
"Aha," says the Syrian. "You have stolen a motor. Furthermore, you have just done it because it's still running."
Another of Ahmed's stories, and he swears this one is true, is about a checkpoint on a hill where the Syrian soldier wanted to inspect a car trunk.
"I can't get out," said the driver. "I have no emergency brake, and I must keep my foot on the brake pedal, or the car will roll away."
"Don't worry," said the Syrian. "I will sit in the car and hold the brake pedal."
So they changed places.
"Now open the trunk," said the Syrian.
The driver opened it.
"All right,"
yelled the Syrian from inside the car.
"Is there any contraband in there?"
What the Syrians are looking for in your trunk, by the way, is Playboy magazines. Be sure to carry some. We sat and smoked more cigarettes. Lebanon is not the place to go if you're trying to give that up. Everyone over the age of 6 chain smokes. Long-term health effects are not, these days, a major concern, and it's the worst sort of rudeness not to offer cigarettes at every turn. George fell in love with Carmen, Antoine's sister, a beauty of about 15. George could talk of nothing else for the rest of the trip but getting married and becoming Maronite. Maybe the feeling was mutual. Antoine took me aside later and asked me if George was a Christian. I assured him most blonde, blue-eyed Americans over 6 feet tall are not Druze. He then nicked me, instead of George, for the 200 Lebanese pounds it allegedly cost to get in the Gibran house. We went on up into the mountains to the cedars, one of only 3 small groves of these trees left. Once the country was forested with them, 100 feet high at full growth and 40 feet in circumference. It was from these the tall masts of the Phoenician galleys were made, and the roof beams of Solomon's temple and so forth. The trees in the Bashari Grove look like they need flea collars, and the grounds are a mess. We found a good hotel, the La Marie, about 10 miles west of Bashari in Edin. Edin is notable for the country's best-looking martyr pictures. There are martyr pictures everywhere in Lebanon. The Falangists put up photographs of the ox-faced Bashir Jamal, who got elected president in 82 and blown to bits within the month. The Shiites plaster walls with the face of some dumpy Ayatollah who went MIA in Libya. The Druze have Kamal Jumblat, who looked dead even before the hitmen ventilated his limo. Edin, however, is the headquarters of the Giants militia, led by the very photogenic Frangia family. In 1978, the Falangists attacked the Frangia home and killed a handsome son, his pretty wife, and their little daughter, too. If you have to look at pictures of dead people all day, they might as well be cute. From Edin, with light traffic and no mood swings at the checkpoints, it's only 2 hours back to Beirut. The remaining great thing to see in Lebanon is Baalbek, site of 3 immense Roman temples, among the largest in the ancient world. Baalbek, however, is in the Bekaa Valley, where Israeli and Syrian forces are faced off and where Israel has been making periodic airstrikes on Syrian missile emplacements. Take sturdy and practical clothing. Baalbek itself is controlled by an extremely radical pro-Khomeini Shiite group called Islamic Amal. The leader of Islamic Amal is Hussein Mousawi. He has close ties to Iran, and many people believe he personally ordered the suicide attacks on the American embassy and the U.S. Marine base at Green Beach. The Islamic Amal people are so far out there that they think Syria is a puppet of international Zionism. When I first arrived in Beirut, the Syrian army had Baalbek surrounded with tanks and was shelling downtown. I went to Baalbek with ABC's chief Beirut correspondent, Charles Glass, and 2 drivers, one Syrian and one Lebanese Shiite. Glass was later kidnapped by radical Shiites, possibly this same Islamic Amal. After 2 months in captivity, he made a harrowing escape. The ride over the crest of the Lebanese range is breathtaking. The arid reaches of the anti-Lebanese mountains rise in the distance. Below is the flat green trough of the Bekaa, where Syrian and Israeli lines are lost in verdant splendor. The thin neck of the Fertile Crescent is spread out before you, cradle of the civilization that has made airstrikes possible. It's overwhelming. At the foot of the descent is the large Christian town of Zala, a phalange outpost surrounded by Muslims. The Syrians shell this sometimes, too. Zala has a good hotel, the Qadri, and an arcade of outdoor restaurants built along a stream in the Wadi Ares, or Valley of Vines. The road north to Baalbek runs up the middle of the Bekaa. Marijuana fields stretch for miles on either side. This is the source of Lebanon's renowned hashish. Don't try to export any yourself, however. The airport customs officials won't search you when you arrive, but they're very thorough when you leave. Taking hashish out of the country without payoffs is one of the few crimes they still prosecute in Lebanon. Bedouins from the Syrian desert camp beside the hemp fields. They're not very romantic up close. Their tents are made from old grain sacks, and everything around them stinks of goat. The ruins of the Roman temples at the Baalbek are, words fail me, big. The amount of mashed thumbs and noses full of stone dust that went into chiseling these is too awesome to contemplate. The largest, the Temple of Jupiter, is 310 feet long, 175 feet wide, and was originally enclosed by 54 Corinthian pillars, each 66 feet high and 7.5 feet thick. Only six are left standing now. The temple complex was 3 centuries in building and never finished. The Christian emperor, Theodosius, ordered the work stopped in hope of suppressing paganism and bringing a halt to a very lively-sounding cult of temple prostitution. Once again, we found a lonely tour guide who took us around, spouting names and numbers and pointing out things that are extra odd or large. The ruins are policed by the Syrians, who are doing a better job than the Israelis at Tyre. The captain in charge came up and introduced himself. His English consisted of, "Hello." "Hello," he said, and shook hands. "Hello," he said, and waved goodbye. Outside the ruins, Baalbek is a tense and spooky place. All the Christians, Sunnis, and Druze have fled. Giant posters of Khomeini are hanging everywhere. There are few women on the streets, and they are carefully scarved and dressed down to the feet. The men gave us hard looks and fingered their weapons. The streets were dirty and grim. Syrian soldiers stayed bunched together. The tanks are still dug in around the city. You cannot get a drink or listen to Western music or dance or gamble, and you'd better not whistle the Star-Spangled Banner. The tour guide led us directly from the temples to a souvenir store. There was something about risking my life to visit a pest hole full of armed lunatics and then going shopping that appealed to me. The store looked like it hadn't been visited since the Crusades, except all the ancient artifacts were new, made this month, and buried in the yard for a week. The nonsense you hear about bargaining in the Orient is, like most nonsense about the Orient, perfectly true. I had not been in the shop 3 seconds before the owner was quoting prices that would do justice to a Pentagon parts supplier and flopping greasy, ill-made rugs in every direction, like somebody house-training a puppy with the Sunday New York Times. There's a charming banter that goes with all this. I mean, I suppose there is. Some of the verbal flourishes of the Levant are lost in a minimal English vocabulary.
"Good, huh? Real good, huh? Good rug. Very good." "He has a cousin in St. Louis," added the tour guide, helpfully.
It seemed I had to hold up both ends in this legendary duel of wit in the bazaar. "Tell him," I said to the guide, "his goods are of the greatest magnificence, and pleasure flows into my eyes at their splendor. Yes, and I am astonished at the justice of his prices. And yet I must abase myself into the dust at the humbleness of my means. I, a poor traveler, come many miles over great distances," and so forth. Out came bogus Egyptian doghead statues, phony Roman coins, counterfeit Phoenician doodads, and more and worse and bigger rugs. After an hour and a half, I felt I had to pay for my fun. I settled on a small bronze Babylonian cow with some decidedly un-Babylonian rasp marks on the casting. I bargained the shopkeeper down from $200 to $30. Good work if the cow hadn't been worth $0. Charles Glass has spent years in the Middle East and was completely bored by this, however. He said we should go meet Hussein Mousawi. Our Shi'i driver was sent to negotiate. After the customary amount of temporizing and dawdle, Hussein consented to see us. We were taken to a shabby and partly destroyed section of town where we were surrounded by nervous young gunmen. though whether they were nervous about us or nervous that they might get a sudden invite to make like a human 4th of July, I don't know. We were marched into a tiny and dirty office and told to sit down. We waited. Then we were marched to a larger office furnished Arab style with couches around the sides of the room. Khomeini pictures abounded. We were served tea, and Charles and I, though not our Muslim drivers, were very thoroughly searched. Charles's tape recorder was taken apart with special care. Our guards were pleasant, but small talk did not seem the order of the day. We waited some more. Finally, another group of armed young men came and took us through a warren of narrow, filthy alleys to a modest and well-protected house. We were put into a small study, lined with Arabic books and decorated with more pictures of Khomeini. There were two young men who spoke English waiting for us. They asked in an affable way what was going on with U.S. foreign policy.
"After all," said one, "this part of the world has a Muslim majority. Is your government crazy or what?"
Half an hour later, Hussein came in and shook hands with everyone. He's a thin man of middle size, about 45. He was dressed in a sort of semi-military leisure suit and was very calm and dignified in his bearing, but had, I swear it, a twinkle in his eye. Hussein ordered a gunman to bring us coffee and cigarettes. The young man, who spoke English less well, acted as translator.
"Were you responsible for the bombing of the Marine base?" asked Charles. I nearly lit my nose instead of the Marlboro.
Hussein answered with equanimity, pointing out that any number of people, including the American Democratic Party, stood to benefit from the attack on the Marines.
"How long will this peace last in Lebanon?" asked Charles.
"This is not peace."
"When will there be peace?"
"When there is Islamic justice everywhere,"
came the answer.
"Everywhere?" asked Charles. "Will there be a place for Christians and Jews under Islamic justice?"
"Islam allows a place for everyone," said Hussein.
The translator paused and added on his own.
"Except, you know, Zionists and imperialists and other types."
"The Zionists will have to be driven out?"
"Yes."
"That may take a long time," said Charles.
Hussein fixed him with a smile.
"Long for you, short for us."
Hussein expounded upon the destiny of Islam and a believing man's place therein. The translator got himself tangled up with
Allah's great wishes, I mean large would-be's, that is...
"The will of God," I suggested.
Hussein turned to me and spoke in English.
"Do you understand Arabic?"
"No," I said. "I just recognized the concept." He said something to the translator, who said to me,
"He wants to know if you believe in God."
I didn't think I should quibble.
"Of course," I said.
Hussein nodded. There was intensity in his look, and no little human concern. He continued on subjects theological.
"To get back down to earth for a moment," said Charles.
Hussein laughed.
"Oh," said the translator, "all this is very much down to earth."
Charles continued to ask questions. I continued to ponder Hussein. He was practically the first Lebanese I'd met who didn't tell me he had a cousin in Oklahoma City, although, as it turns out, his brother is a petroleum engineer who used to work in Dallas. Charles asked Hussein about Jonathan Wright, the missing Reuters correspondent.
"I hadn't heard about this," was the reply. "Also, he wasn't headed this way."
Hussein told Charles he should study the Quran. At length we took our leave. As we were being escorted back to our car, I noticed a woman on a nearby roof wearing a chador and hanging out lacy black lingerie on the clothesline. Less than a week after our visit, the U.S. Embassy annex in East Beirut got blown up. I hope it wasn't anything we said. The hotel at Baalbek is the Palmyra, built in the 1870s. It's a massive Ottoman structure, furnished with antique carpets and heavy mahogany Victorian furniture. The leather-bound guest register bears the signatures of Louis Napoleon, the Duke d'Orléans, the Empress of Abyssinia, and Kaiser Wilhelm II. There's an air of twilight and deliquescence to the place. Only the owner and a couple old servants are left. No room had been occupied for months, and only an occasional Syrian military officer comes to dinner. Charles and I sat alone that night in the vast dining room. Pilgrims were still returning from Mecca, and celebratory gunshots sounded outside. Happy Fire, it's called.
The electricity guttered in the bulbs and cast the long tables and tall ceiling into gloom. The forces of darkness and barbarism seemed to gather around. It was as though we were the last two white men in Asia. We sat up past midnight, drinking the bottle of arak a grizzled waiter had smuggled to us, talking politics and literature, and citing apt quotations. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world, the blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and you just can't find travel like this anymore. Soul Brothers. December 1987. When the kid in the front row at the rally bit off the tip of his little finger and wrote Kim Dae-jung in blood on his fancy white ski jacket, I think that was the first time I ever really felt like a foreign correspondent. I mean, here was something really fucking foreign. It wasn't even an act of desperate protest. Opposition candidate Kim Dae-jung hadn't lost the Korean presidential election yet. KDJ was just giving a small pep talk to a group of well-wishers. 500,000 of them. They spread in every direction out over the horizon, packed flank to flank and butt to loin, all standing at attention in a freezing Seoul drizzle, with serious, purposeful expressions on their mugs. When a Korean political candidate does a little stumping, a little flesh-pressing, a little baby-kissing, he puts on a sour face, mounts a platform, and stares at the crowd. He's surrounded by Samoan-sized bodyguards, his japse, or goons. Literally, trapped birds. A couple of the goons hold an inch-thick plexiglass shield in front of the candidate's face. The shield has handles bolted on both ends, like a see-through tea tray. The crowd shouts the candidate's name for half an hour. Then the candidate yells at the crowd. Korean sounds like ak-ak fire. Every syllable has a primary accent.
Yo-yo, cap, stove, ham, hock, dipstick, duck soup, hat ring, ping-pong, lip-sync.
If the candidate pauses, the crowd responds in unison with a rhymed slogan or with a precise 15 seconds of waving little paper Korean flags. There is no frenzy in this, no mob hysteria, and it's not a drill or an exercise. I'd never seen spontaneous regimentation before, and I don't hope to see it again. I was standing on the platform, a couple of goons away from the DJ, as the foreign reporters call Kim Dae-jung, and I was looking at this multitude, and I was thinking, oh no, they really do all look alike. The same black llama hair, the same high-boned pie plate face, the same tea-stained complexion, the same sharp-focused look and 1,000,000 identical anthracite eyes. They are a strange northern people who came to this mountain peninsula an ice age ago and have kept their bloodlines intact through 1,000 invasions. Their language is unrelated to Chinese or Japanese, closer, in fact, to Finnish and Hungarian. They don't like anyone who isn't Korean, and they don't like each other all that much either. They're hard-hearted, hard-drinking, tough little bastards. The Irish of Asia. There was a very un-Irish order to that crowd, however. An order beyond my comprehension, like nuclear fission. There is an order to everything in Korea. They call it kibun, which means, to the extent it can be translated, harmonious understanding. Everything in Korea is orderly, except when it isn't. Like nuclear fission. The speech ended, and every single person in that audience pushed forward to be with Kim Dae-jung. I looked down from the platform and saw the kid in the front row wiggle out of his white parka. He was a normal-looking kid, but in Korea everybody is normal-looking. He had a sign reading, in garbled English, Mr. Kim DJ only become the first president of the world, on one side, and the same, I guess, in Korean on the other. Then, with a can-do smile, he nipped the digit and began his calligraphy. The DJ, in a goon envelope, descended to meet his chanting admirers. I tried, without goons, to follow him. I was cross-body blocked and stiff-armed and went down in a second. I was a one-man zone defense against a football team of 500,000. Squat, rock-hard Korean bodies surrounded me in three dimensions. I was squeezed and heaved and, most of all, overwhelmed by the amazing stink of kimchi, the garlic and hot pepper sauerkraut that's breakfast, lunch, and dinner in Korea. Its odor rises from this nation of 40 million in a miasma of eyeglass-fogging kimchi breath. throat-searing kimchi burps and terrible pant-splitting kimchi farts. I came to the surface of the crowd and went under again like a toddler in Big Surf. I was squashed and tumbled. My foot came out of my shoe. My pocket was picked. Finally, I was expelled from the mass with one collective shove and kick. This is what Koreans are like when they're happy. And the Koreans were very happy with their first presidential election in 16 years. They voted like the Dickens, an 89.2% turnout. But I couldn't get any of them to tell me why. What was this election supposed to be about? Practically everybody running for president was named Kim. There was Kim Dae-jung, the opposition frontrunner, Kim Young-sam, Kim the sequel, also the opposition frontrunner, and Kim Jong-bil, Kim the early years, the opposition straggler. Plus, there was the non-Kim candidate, Roh Tae-woo, pronounced No Tae-woo and called Just Say No by the Foreign Press Corps. Roh was handpicked by the military dictatorship that's been running South Korea since 1971. Everybody knew Roh was going to win because Kim the DJ and Kim the sequel had promised to unite anti-government opposition behind one candidate, but then they forgot and spent most of the campaign bickering with each other. And Roh was going to win anyway because he had the constituency that votes with M16s. When these boys make their voices heard in the marketplace of ideas, you'd better listen up. So the election wasn't about winning. And the election wasn't about political party allegiance either. The distinctively named parties, Peace and Democracy, Democratic Justice, Reunification Democratic, and New Democratic Republican, all fielded candidates. If I were a hard-working journalist with a keen eye for detail, I'd sift through my notes now and tell you what Kim belonged to which. But that would be a waste of everybody's time. A Korean political party exists solely to boost the fortunes of its founding candidate and has the average lifespan of a trout stream mayfly hatch. Campaign promises? Kim's 1-2-3 promised to promote freedom of expression, work for reunification of North and South, fight corruption, improve the country's god-awful human rights record, raise living standards, and lower taxes. But then, that fascist pig Roh Tae-woo went out and promised to do the same, and lots more of it. Nobody, Kim or un-Kim, said too much about Korea's near absence of social security programs, the $140 a month minimum wage, the 72-hour work week, or the fact that it's illegal to have an independent labor union. Kim Dae-jung is supposed to be the big liberal in the bunch. When interviewed by a Canadian business magazine, the DJ, that feisty champion of the common man, was quoted as saying, "Of course we want to advocate some social welfare, but we do not want to be excessive. If trade unions advocate extreme or radical demands, the law must prohibit this." So the election wasn't about campaign promises. Why was everybody voting so hard? The only answer I could get from Koreans was democracy. "What's this election all about?" I asked.
"Democracy," they answered.
"But what is democracy?" I said.
"Good."
"Yes, of course, but why exactly?"
"It's more democratic that way."
Well, this is heartening to those of us who prefer a democratic system, but I still don't know what they're talking about.
"Korea must have democracy," my Korean friends told me. "Democracy is very good for Korea. Korean people want very much democracy."
I guess democracy is something that if you're going to be really up to date, you just can't do without, like a compact disc player. Actual South Korean experience with democracy, by the way, consists of one 13-month period between the April 1960 overthrow of strongman Syngman Rhee and the May 1961 military coup by General Park Chung-hee. On election day, I cruised Seoul with an old friend from the democracy fad in the Philippines, photographer John Giannini. It was supposed to be a national holiday, but the Koreans went to work just the same, the way they do 6 days a week, starting before dawn and stopping who knows when. Rush hour doesn't even begin until 7 p.m. Traffic in Seoul is a 50-mile-per-hour gridlock, with nobody getting anywhere and everybody driving like hell. The sidewalks are endless rugby scrums. Elbowing your way through a crowd is Korean for, "Excuse me." The city is as gray as a parking garage and cleaner than a living room. People stoop and pick up any piece of litter they see. You can spend 20 minutes in an agony of embarrassment trying to figure out what to do with a cigarette butt. And they yell at you if you cross against the light. Everything is made of concrete and glass and seems unrelentingly modern at first glance. But many buildings have no central heating, and the smell of kerosene stoves pours out every shop door, mixing with kimchi fumes, car smoke, sewer funk, and the stink of industry. It's a tough, homely stench, the way America's ethnic factory towns must have smelled 75 years ago. Giannini and I tried to find the slums of Seoul, but the best we could do was a cramped, rough-hewn neighborhood with spotless, bicycle-wide streets. Every resident was working, hauling, stacking, hawking, welding, making things in sheds no larger than doghouses. Come back in a few years, and each shed will be another Hyundai Corporation. We felt like big, pale drones in the hive of the worker bees. The voting was just what every journalist dreads, quiet and well-organized. There were no Salvadoran shoot-em-ups, no Haitian baton-twirler machete attacks, no puddles of Chicagoan sleaze running out from under the voting booths. People were standing patiently in line, holding their signature seals, their chops at the ready. Poll watchers from each candidate's party sat to one side, rigid on a row of straight-backed chairs. A reporter who could make an interesting paragraph out of this would get that special Pulitzer they give out for keeping readers awake during discussions of civic virtue. Kim Dae-jung and Kim Young-sam said there was massive vote fraud. But if there was, it was serious, orderly, Korean massive vote fraud. Giannini and I did see one fellow getting roughed up by a crowd outside a polling place. We shoved people, in the Korean manner, until we found someone who spoke English. He told us the fellow being kicked and punched was a suspected government agent. The police came, punched and kicked the fellow some more, and hauled him off. It was certainly the first time I'd ever seen police arrest somebody on suspicion of being a government agent, but that's Korea. We went out in the country to find people voting in authentic, traditional, funny clothes. But this, too, was a bore. So we gave up and went to a restaurant. A few floor mats and a kerosene heater and a tent beside the Han River. The Han is as wide as the Hudson, and its valley is as beautiful as a Hudson River school painting, but more serious, with a gray wash over it. The Koreans are serious about fun, too, thank God. They're perfectly capable of a 3-hour lunch, and so are Giannini and I. We ordered dozens of bowls of pickles, garlics, red peppers, and hot sauces, and dozens of plates of spiced fish and vegetables, and great big bottles of OB beer, and mixed it all with kimchi so strong it would have sent a Mexican screaming from the room with tongue in flames. By the time we drove, weaving, back to Seoul, you could have used our breath to clean your oven. After the votes were counted, the Koreans were not very happy with their first presidential election in 16 years. Most citizens responded in the Korean way by going to work in the morning. But some student radical types decided they'd found a big vote fraud in a ward, or gu, office in the industrial district of Kuro, in southern Seoul. As usual, I couldn't figure out what was going on. Korea has an infinite capacity to make you feel dumb. This is a whole nation of people who did their homework on Friday night. Even when they don't know what they're doing so damn much of it that they're still going to get an A. Anyway, the student radicals discovered a locked ballot box under a stack of bread and milk in a truck leaving the Kurogu compound. Local officials gave some lame excuse about how the ballot box had to go to a special vote-counting place, and how the bread and milk truck just happened to be headed that way, and how they'd covered the ballot box to keep the votes from getting cold. The students were having none of it. They invaded the 5-story Kurogu building, took the local officials hostage, and called for one of those massive, violent student demonstrations for which Korea is justly famous. The way famous, massive, violent Korean student demonstrations work is that the students get a sound truck, turn the volume up to Motley Crue, and take turns screaming at themselves. Violent student demonstrators sit around cross-legged in an appreciative half-circle and, between screams, holler, "Dakche Tado! Dakche Tado! Dakche Tado!" which means smash the dictatorship. The chant is punctuated with unnerving, black-shirtish, synchronized karate chops. This can go on for days, and at Kuro, it did. Meanwhile, extra-violent student demonstrators were breaking paving stones into handy projectiles, filling soju rice wine bottle kerosene bombs, building desk and filing cabinet barricades in the Kurogu doorways, and pulling apart some nearby scaffolding to make quarter staves out of iron pipe. A line of command had been created, and all defense preparations were taking place behind a row of stick-wielding young malcontents. Lack of press freedom in Korea is one of the big student gripes, but the students don't like actual reporters any better than the government does, at least not American reporters. The radicals, in counterfeit New Balance shoes, Levi's knockoffs, and unlicensed Madonna t-shirts, are much given to denouncing American dominance of Korean culture. It took a lot of arguing to get past these ding-dongs. One pair, a dog-faced, grousing fat girl in glasses, and a weedy, mouthy, fever-eyed boy, were almost as obnoxious as my girlfriend and I were 20 years ago at the March on the Pentagon. However, they had some oddly Korean priorities.
"Don't you step on bushes!"
shouted the fat girl as I made my way into the building that they were tearing to shreds. Inside, firebombs were parked neatly in crates, stones were gathered in tidy piles, more lengths of pipe were laid in evenly spaced rows to booby-trap the stairs, and additional barricades were being carefully constructed on the landings. Looking down from the roof, I saw little groups of students break away from the chanting and form themselves into squads, squatting in formation. They dakche tarod for a while, then quick marched to the front lines around the Kurogu compound, where each was given an assigned position and his own firebomb to sit patiently beside. Demonstrators continued to arrive, bringing boxes of food, fruit juice, and cigarettes. You had to admire the students' industry and organization, if not their common sense. The Kurogu building faced a spike-fenced courtyard with only one narrow gate to the street. There was no way out the back of the place, except through the upper-story windows or off the roof. And right next door, completely overshadowing the scene, was a huge police station. 4,000 policemen gathered there that evening in their distinctive Darth Vader outfits, black gas masks, Nazi helmets, and stiff olive-drab pants and jackets stuffed with protective padding. The government assault came on Friday morning, 2 days after the election. It was well underway by the time I arrived at 8 a.m. You go to cover a Korean riot story looking more like a Martian than a Woodward or a Bernstein. You wear heavy clothes for protection from the cold and rocks, good running shoes, a hard hat or motorcycle helmet marked press in English and Korean, and the best gas mask you can find on the black market. It's illegal for civilians to buy them in Korea. Korean riot police used the pepper gas developed during the Vietnam War, which is fast becoming a favorite with busy dictators everywhere. I'd been hit with the stuff before, in Panama, but the Koreans lay it on in lavish doses until the air is a vanilla milkshake of minuscule caustic particles. Pepper gas can raise blisters on exposed skin. Any contact with the mucous membrane produces the same sensation as probing a canker sore with a hot sewing needle. The tiniest amount in your eyes, and your eyelids lock shut in blind agony. Breathing it is like inhaling fish bones, and the curl-up-and-die cough quickly turns to vomiting. Pepper gas is probably the only thing on Earth more powerful than kimchi. There was street fighting going on all around Kurogu, in an orderly way, of course. First, the Darth Vader cops form a line with shields interlocked. Then the students run up and throw firebombs at them. The police respond with a volley of tear gas rifle grenades. The students throw stones. The police fire tear gas again and then charge. The police hardly ever catch a student. That would disturb the kibun of the set-piece battle. Instead, there's a squad of volunteers from the police ranks called grabbers. The grabbers dress in down-filled L.L. Bean-type parkas, jeans, Nikes, and white motorcycle helmets. They carry hippie tourist-style canvas shoulder bags filled with tear gas grenades and swing long batons that look like hiking staffs. Their jackets are all in pleasant shades of beige and baby blue, color-coordinated by squadrons. With gas masks in place, the grabbers look like a bunch of mentally unbalanced freelance writers for Outside magazine. The grabbers huddle behind the riot police. As soon as the students break ranks, the grabbers spring out and do their grabbing, beating the shit out of anyone they lay hands on. The beaten students are then led away. Student demonstrators are not often formally arrested in Korea. They are just led away. What happens to them next is, I hear, even less fun than getting caught in a Kim Dae-jung rally. Being out in no man's land, between the students and the police, isn't much fun either. Rifle grenades were flying through the air, and stones were racketing on the top of my hard hat. Plus, there was this creepy XXX video rubber fetish thing all over my face. No gas mask is fully effective against the pepper gas clouds, and mine looked as if it dated back to the Crimean War. Inside it, I was coughing and weeping and thoroughly panicked, and outside it, barely visible through the scratched and fogged-over eyepieces, was the world's only mayhem with choreography. I had stumbled on stage in mid-performance of some overenthusiastic Asian production of West Side Story. Back at Kurogu itself, the police had retaken the courtyard and first four stories of the building, but the students were still holding the top floor and roof. The students don't wear gas masks. They put on those little Dr. Dan and Nurse Nancy cotton face things, and they smear toothpaste on their skin. But otherwise, they riot unprotected. The police in the courtyard were firing salvos of gas grenades, 20 at a time, into the fifth-floor windows and onto the roof. The gas bursts looked like albino fireworks. The police also have armored cars with gun turrets that shoot small tear gas canisters at hundreds of rounds a minute. Two of these had been set in flanking positions and were raking the rooftop. That the students could even stand in this maelstrom was a testament to Koreanness. But they were not only standing. They were fighting like sons of bitches. The barricades in the stairwells had been set on fire, and columns of ash were rising above the building. I could see blurred hand-to-hand action inside as windows shattered and pipes and batons flashed. The students were raining everything they could lift on the police. The Irish confetti was dancing off upraised shields and bouncing and ricocheting all around in the courtyard. Two fire trucks had been brought through the gate, and their extension ladders were thrust as near to the roof as even a Korean would dare. A couple of overbrave firemen went scurrying topside in a smoke of stones. The adrenaline zanied kids fended off water blasts with their protest placards and with ordinary umbrellas, the fabric tearing from the spokes in seconds. A stray gas grenade slammed into one of the extension ladders, inspiring vivid gestures from the fireman to his colleagues below. The top of the otherwise modern cement Kurogu office was fringed, Burger King fashion, with a mansard roof of traditional tiles. When the students ran out of stones and bottles, they began pulling loose these fat parentheses of baked clay and sailing them out over the courtyard. Weighing 10 pounds apiece and coming from 50 feet in the air, they had the impact of small mortar shells. If you kept your eye on the trajectories, you could move out of the way in time. But to stop watching the sky for even 10 seconds was curtains. I saw 6 or 7 cops carried away, heads lolling and blood running out from under their helmets. I turned a shoulder to the building to write that in my notebook, and half a tile flew past me so close I felt the wind through the fly of my 501s. If I'd been standing 1 inch to the south, I'd be writing this in soprano. About 8:45, the police cleared the top floor, and the grabbers, or White Skull Police as the students call them, appeared at the windows, waving victoriously. But the cops below were slow on the uptake, and the grabbers got hit with another round of gas. The students on the roof kept at it. One wild young fool spent the entire battle balanced on the roof tiles, dancing back and forth, chased by streams of water from the fire hoses and ducking the gas grenades fired at his head. Every time a grenade missed, he'd bow grandly to the police. It's not enough that these guys are better than we are at making cars, ships, TVs, stereos, cameras, computers, steel, and binoculars. Now, they're building a better Berkeley and Kent State. The final assault came about 9 a.m. There was one double door to the roof, and only 4 grabbers could get through it at a time. Photographer Tony Swa, with whom I'd covered the Aquino-Marcos election mess, was standing right behind the first wave. He said the grabbers were obviously scared, and the first 4 who charged out were flung back inside, bruised and bleeding. But the grabbers persisted, 4 by 4, until they secured the doorway. Then 100 of them pushed outside. From the ground, it was a Punch and Judy show. The down-bulked grabbers in their helmets and masks were visible only from the chest up behind the parapets. They were thrashing maniacally with their long batons. You could tell when they got a student down. Suddenly, a stick would be moving in a single arc with burlesque speed. Whack-a-whack-a-whack-a-whack-a-whack-a-whack-a-whack. I saw the bowing kid pulled from his perch and given the Mrs. Punch treat.